Introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
For the record, my name is Robert Schmidt. I'm the Director of the Division of Banking and Securities. Thank you for holding this hearing to discuss the Money Transmission Modernization Act. This bill impacts an industry that most Alaskans carry in their pocket. Alaskans use money transmission, particularly mobile payments like Cash App or Venmo, thousands of times an hour to transfer billions of dollars a year. What does this bill do? The Money Transmission Modernization Act is a generational update to financial laws to accommodate new technologies and ensure uniformity. It's based on the Uniform Money Transmission Act, which was developed by state regulators, the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, which every state and every U.S. territory is a member, with input and participation from industry stakeholders, some of whom you'll be hearing from later. This bill reduces regulatory burden by streamlining licensing, renewal, examinations, and the other changes in a business life cycle. It protects Alaskan consumers by conducting criminal background checks to the nationwide multi-state licensing system, NMLS, in addition to other changes. It broadens the definition of money transmission and defines virtual currency activities, and it ensures the Division of Banking and Securities can coordinate with other states in all areas of regulation, licensing, and supervision to reduce the burden on industry and more effectively utilize regulator resources. Money transmission goes back to the Middle Ages, when the Knights Templar established a system for persons to deposit gold and silver in Europe and withdraw it in Jerusalem. In America, money transmission took hold with the westward expansion of the country, with entities such as Western Union accepting money on the East Coast, then sending a telegram to an office near the intended recipient, instructing the local office to give the money to the intended recipient. For over 100 years, this was the pattern of money transmission in America, the sender physically going to a money transmitter's office, instructing an amount of money to be sent to the recipient, and the recipient physically going into the local branch of the money transmitter to receive the money. Alaskans can and still do send money by physically going to a money transmitter. I had dinner last night at the hangar. There's a MoneyGram agent in the hangar. Cruise ship staff regularly go there and physically have money transferred back to their home country. But the industry has grown into so much more. Smartphones have revolutionized the sending and receiving of money. Alaskans now use their smartphones tens of millions of times a year to send billions of dollars. If you have a smartphone, you either have Google Pay or Apple Pay in your pocket. Those are both money transmitters. The Division of Banking and Securities enforces the Alaska Uniform Money Services Act, that's ASO 655, which was passed by this legislature in was passed by the legislature in 2007 and implemented in 2008. The Uniform Money Services Act of 2008 provides the legal framework for money transmission functions, including currency exchange, transfer or wiring of money, and loading and reloading of payment instruments, including store value cards. That is, for example, the cards you can pick up at the grocery store, load money on, give them as a gift. Those are also covered by money transmission. Mobile payments and cryptocurrency were both started in 2009. The first beta version of PayPal was released for the BlackBerry, remember those, in 2009. Cryptocurrency was invented in 2009 in response to the global financial crisis. The current law, as I've mentioned, became effective in 2008, was passed in 2007, and was written in 2004. That is to say, what is money transmission today? What is two-thirds of money transmission today did not exist when the current law was written. Moving on to the next slide, money transmission volume. This chart shows the impressive growth of total money transmission value in Alaska annually from $1.6 billion in 2019 to over $7 billion in 2021. In 2023, the last year for which, of course, we have data available, annual money transmission was about $4.5 billion. These totals include money transmission, payment instruments, stored value, and virtual currency. The volume dipped in 2022 due to the volatile crypto market and bankruptcies of several crypto exchanges, most notably FTX, Voyager, and Celsius. We expect a rebound in 2024 as Bitcoin, the most widely traded cryptocurrency, is now setting record highs. Regardless of crypto's future, this sector will continue to grow extensively as utilization of mobile payment systems increases. Many Alaskans live in communities without a brick-and-mortar bank. Mobile payment systems offer a way for Alaskans to pay for, or be paid for, goods and services where the only requirement is cellular data or internet connection. The next slide shows the explosive growth in Alaskans using money transmission. The number of transactions was over 25 million in 2023, meaning Alaskans conducted a money transmission transaction 48.6 times per minute. That's 2,900 times per hour, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. I've been speaking for about 10 minutes, so we're coming up on about 500 money transmission transactions have happened in Alaska since I've been talking. As mentioned before, the money transmission growth has been driven by two factors. The first and by far the largest is mobile payment applications on smartphones. These include Venmo, Cash App, Coinbase, Block, Square, Robinhood, etc., or embedded functionality like Apple Pay, Google Pay, or MetaPay. Any Alaskan with a smartphone has money transmission services in their pocket. This next graph, frankly, it surprises me a little bit. The number of money transmission licensees continues to grow. As of December 31st, 2023, Alaska had 180 money transmitter licenses, with at least 35 of those conducting virtual currency business activity that was not regulated. Over the last 5 years, the number of companies with money transmission licenses has increased 59%. Today, online transactions conducted by smartphone and virtual currency such as Bitcoin are now common means of exchanging and/or transferring payment or value. Proposed legislation is necessary to appropriately supervise and regulate money transmitters to protect Alaskan consumers. Going back to the prior slide, what surprises me about this is we have, how many with zero volume? We have almost 50 licensees who do zero business in Alaska. They are paying the fee to become licensed simply to be covered, to have their bases covered, to be licensed in every state. That is reflective of the growth in this industry, that you have startups that are still coming into this industry. Even though crypto had a really tough year, you're continuing to see this industry grow. And the penetration and reach of mobile payment applications is certainly going to increase and not decrease. Looking specifically at virtual currency, aka cryptocurrency, it shows the explosive growth, and as of the last 2 years, the steadier value of reported annual virtual currency transmission in Alaska. All of these statistics are reported by companies that are licensed to conduct money transmission in Alaska and also have virtual currency activity. Reported virtual currency transmission in Alaska grew almost 6,000% between 2019 and 2021, from $33.6 million to a high of $1.9 billion. Alaska did not regulate virtual currency at all until 2023. A very limited regulations package became effective on January 1st, 2023, adding virtual currency to the definition of money transmission and requiring additional companies to be licensed. In 2023, Alaska had 615 million virtual currency transactions. That's $1.7 million per day every day on average. I would point out that recently Bitcoin has been hitting record highs, and I'm interested to see what that number looks like for 2024. Moving on to the next slide, this pie chart is extremely important. It shows what are the types of money transmission occurring in Alaska. About 70% of it is either mobile payments or sending money. Stored value cards like a Visa card bought at a grocery store and virtual or cryptocurrency are both about equal at 14 and 15%. About two-thirds of money transmission in Alaska is either mobile payments or virtual currency, neither of which existed when the current law was written. One of the three invited testifiers is a gentleman named Laka Peacock. He's located in Nome. He's going to express to you his support for the bill, we hope, and this slide really addresses one of the reasons why. Currently, every money transmitter in Alaska pays the same $3,000 initial application fee and $1,000 renewal fee. That's regardless of whether you do over $1 billion of business in Alaska, $0 of business in Alaska, or anywhere in between. This bill allows us to set our fees by statute. Most states utilize a volume-based fee scheme where the more money you transact, the more business that you transact, that determines the annual renewal fee. It's worth noting that this is a fee paid at the end of the year for renewal. This is not a fee that is paid by consumers when they conduct a transaction. But here we have a first example of Ohio. This is how Ohio grades their fees or computes their fees. This bill does contain a fiscal note, but it will be revenue neutral in year one. The bill will pay for itself by allowing the division to set fees by regulation. There are currently 180 licensed money transmitters. With the passage of SB 84, the division will establish a reasonable sliding scale that is business-friendly, considers volume and regulatory burden. This will result in the bill funding itself. Many states utilize a sliding fee scale based on volume. The division has considered the sliding fee scales of Texas and Ohio, and utilizing either of those based on 2023 Alaska numbers would result in this bill being revenue neutral. The next slide is how Texas computes their fees. Under the Ohio example, using Ohio's numbers and Alaska's 2023 volume, the fiscal note for year one of this bill is $496,000. Utilizing the Ohio fee structure would generate $852,000 of revenue. Using the Texas example would result in $672,000 of revenue. We are not going to simply plug in or adopt one state's or another's, but we will. The key point being that we will adopt a fee that reasonably funds the program. Speaking more generally about the division, in fiscal year 2013, the division received $12.9 million on a budget of $3.58 million. Receipts in fiscal year 2023 were $22.4 million on a budget of $4.32 million. The fiscal note for this position includes five full-time positions, three in fiscal year 25 and two in fiscal year 26. The division has always made a contribution to the general fund that is several times larger than its budget and will continue to do so. By allowing fees to be set in regulation, the division will be able to incentivize doing business in Alaska and consider regulatory burden and risk to consumers in assessing fees. Why is this bill important? This bill will protect consumers. It will reduce regulatory burden. It adopts a model law passed in 18 states, pending in 11 states, that industry drafted with state regulators. It will prevent federal preemption by creating uniform statutes across this country. And this bill will allow the division to have the ability to update fees and activities that require license and regulation to keep up with technology and innovation in this ever-evolving financial industry. Events of the last years have demonstrated the need for modernization of Alaska's money transmission laws. We appreciate the committee's work on this important issue and hope we can continue working together to advance this legislation. I'd like to... Next slide. Looks like we're missing a slide. I apologize for the dissonance between my written notes. Why regulate money transmission at all? One more back. In speaking with regulators, thank you. In speaking with legislators, excuse me, we've been asked why regulate money transmission at all. 55 states and U.S. territories regulate money transmission. There is, like we have the FDIC for banks and the NCUA for credit unions, there is no federal regulatory body for money transmission. This has always historically been regulated by the states. Industry wants this bill adopted. States want to preserve their right to oversee their financial institutions operating in their state. No industry stakeholder or state regulator wants to see federal preemption. The Division of Banking and Securities is uniquely qualified to protect Alaskans and respond to Alaskans. When we receive public inquiries about having been scammed or having difficulty with a financial institution, if it is a state-chartered or state-regulated activity, we are almost always in a position to help and help quickly. One of the worst outcomes is when we have to tell people, sorry, that's not an area that we regulate. Please contact the CFPB, the NCUA, or the FDIC, or the OCC, and they will get back to you when they get back to you. States have licensed money transmission for over 100 years, and frankly, the federal government has no infrastructure set up to regulate this in the way that states do. We've discussed the fiscal impact. I've talked about why this bill is important, and if you have any questions. The last thought that I'd like to close with is, if you look at the industries that we regulate, the banks, the credit unions, the mortgage lenders, the payday lenders, etc., money transmission is the most dynamic area in the financial industry, and really it's not even close. Much of the financial industry is very staid, quite frankly, kind of boring, but this is where the activity is, this is where the growth is, this is where the change is. We are going to see more people utilizing mobile payment systems, not less. We're going to see more people paying for their groceries by tapping their phone on the cash register, not less. This is really the most dynamic area that we regulate, and like I've said, the existing law was written before this technology was even born. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, before we get on to the questions, I'd like to recognize that Senator Elvigrew Jackson has been with us for the last 10 minutes, and so she's welcome to come on in here. She's the chairman of the Legislative Council. We have any questions for Mr. Schmidt? It's a complicated bill, 55 pages, and so thanks very much for presenting it, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. See on slide 13, the top bullet is protect Alaska consumers. So can you explain why the average Alaskan should care about this bill? And do you have any examples where your department has been beneficial time-wise to deal with versus the FDIC or some other federal organization?
Mr. Schmidt.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. One example, I mentioned the cryptocurrency bankruptcies of 2022. Again, the most noteworthy were Celsius, Voyager, and FTX. Each of those entities had a provision in their agreements with their customers that your account is actually not yours. It is property of this company, and in the event of a bankruptcy, your account is an asset of this company, and you are a general unsecured creditor that is essentially last in line to receive anything. The cryptocurrency provisions of this bill, which only take up 2 pages of the 55-page bill, specify that a cryptocurrency account belongs to the account holder, and in the event of a bankruptcy, it is not an asset of the estate. Had this bill been law at the time of the 2022 crypto winter and the crypto bankruptcies, Alaskans would have not lost about $11 million. Another recent example, we had a business in Southeast Alaska that was the target of a spear phishing scam where somebody with inside knowledge of their target impersonated a vendor and gave false payment instructions on what was an otherwise credible looking invoice. The Southeast business was told that they needed to get this invoice paid in a big hurry. They sent money, about $125,000. They paid on this invoice before realizing that it was a fraudulent invoice. We learned about it on Friday morning. We made a call late Friday morning to First Bank. That happened to be in Southeast, which is a state chartered bank primarily regulated by us. First Bank answers our calls. They were able to immediately reach out to Chase Bank, the recipient, and freeze the transaction. If we had not been able to move literally in minutes of finding out about this and reaching out to the bank and putting a stop on it, that money would have been gone.
So, Bob's understood me?
No, but I have a different question after other people have questions.
Are you finished with the answer, Mr. Schmidt?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Actually, Senator Keel was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schmidt, we talk about regulation. There's lots of things that can fall under that umbrella. Could you just give us, and please not a lot of detail, but you know, we used to regulate airlines and tell them which routes they could run. This I think is not that. What are the things that you control, or broad strokes?
Through the chair, this bill is technology neutral. This bill establishes uniformity across the states. This allows innovation. We are looking for safety, soundness. We are looking for compliance with federal laws, for example, Bank Secrecy Act and Know Your Customer Act laws. Basically, those are intended to prevent money laundering or sanction evasion. Another way to put it, for example, particularly in money transmission, one of the things that we look at is the average daily liabilities of the money transmitter. And a colloquial way to put that is we want to make sure that there is enough cash in the vault to cover the chips on the table. So those are the kinds of things that we are looking for.
Bottom set of Q.
Bunch of stuff in here about fingerprinting. I assume that's to deal with employees and corporate. What's that for?
So one of the things that we look closely at is who the control persons are of these companies. So we're looking at people who are on the senior management, who is on the board of directors, who are majority shareholders. For example, in just maybe a month and a half ago, we denied a fairly significant license renewal application from an outfit called Binance, where Binance's CEO last November pled guilty to federal money laundering charges involving Binance. So we're looking at who owns these companies, who controls these companies, and whether or not they have the appropriate character and fitness to operate these sorts of businesses.
So no fraudsters and forgers. You already said the customer's money belongs to the customer. And you said enough cash to cover. Anything else of significance? You said it's technology neutral. Any other? I'm looking for any places where this bill would let the state tell a company how to do its business, or is that kind of the field?
Mr. Schmidt.
They have to comply with, again, for example, having the cash and reserves to cover the average daily liabilities. They have to make sure that they comply with the Bank Secrecy Act and they know who their customers are. So, for example, getting the names and other information about their customers, that's required by federal law, again, to prevent money laundering. I'm going to defer to my chief of examinations on what other areas she might add to that list.
Yeah, we're looking
Tracy. Identify yourself for the record, Tracy.
Yes. For the record, my name is Tracy Reno. I'm the chief of examinations in the Division of Banking and Securities. Basically, I supervise a staff that goes into the companies and looks at their records. So are they reporting timely and accurately? Are they training their agents who are sitting, you know, on the docks transmitting this money for people so they understand what to do and how to do it and how to help people if there's a problem? We're basically looking at safety and soundness, so their financial stability, the people who are running the company. We're also looking at, like you said, the net worth, the financials, the making sure there's enough funds to cover, whether it's virtual currency or cash for cash. We don't want to stop innovation. We don't want to stop what these people are doing. It's very important to Alaska to have business here, right? We want people to be able to send money however they want to send it. So our job isn't to restrict the way people do business. It's to support them, make sure they understand what it is to be compliant with state and federal law, and to make sure that, you know, we can help them get there if they're having trouble understanding that. So we don't want to stop business. We're here to support it.
Okay. Well, thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Great presentation so far. I'm glad you're there. You saved an Alaskan $100,000 in your speedy and timely efforts. So thanks for that.
Thank you very much, Senator.
So I'm listening to you and I'm trying to get my head wrapped around, you know, we're kind of between two areas here in this bill, in the crypto and then regular online banking. So this crypto banking, you said there's two pages that we cover in banking. So is this, my question is, this cryptocurrency is not FDIC insured, right? Or yes or no?
It is not, Your Honor. Through the chair. To expand, may I?
Please.
Speaking about cryptocurrency can often take up all the oxygen in the room. I would rather that this not be thought of as this is the crypto bill. This is the mobile payments bill. That's really what we're most focused on. Cryptocurrency is important, and it's important by virtue of the fact that it's being used by Alaskans. Not because I think it is important or I think it's good or I don't think it's good. It's a matter of it's here. It's reality. Cryptocurrency is not FDIC insured, although many crypto platforms are working very hard to have a bank fund the parts of their operations that do involve actual cash, what we call fiat currency, real government issued currency. So it is not FDIC insured. It is a important part of this bill, but it's only one part of the whole.
Senator Stedman had another question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just help me a little bit with the fee structure and the concept of that, because it's going to be is there other fee structures in statute? Is this going to be in statute, or how much is going to be in regulation? And give us a little more detail on the structure and flexibility that the department has.
Mr. Schmidt.
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator. Not to steal his thunder, but Mr. Peacock in Nome is a perfect example. He pays the same $3,000 initial application and the same $1,000 renewal fee that Apple pays. He pays the same fee that Coinbase pays. These are people that do hundreds of millions or even over $1 billion of business. The allowing a volume-based assessment where there's a smaller initial amount, but then the fees adjust as you do more and more business, that reflects risk to Alaskans, and it reflects regulatory burden. For example, FTX, which went bankrupt and formerly run by Sam Bankman-Fried, who is now in federal prison for various federal charges, they had a fantastically large amount of volume in 2021, and they presented a great regulatory risk, a great regulatory burden, a great risk to Alaskan consumers. That is not to paint every big company with the same brush, but the more activity it is that you do, the more you are going to present a potential risk to Alaskans or a burden on the division to make sure that you are operating in a safe and sound way. So it makes it much more fair, much more business friendly by helping the smaller or more local entities and accurately representing the risk of the very, very large money transmitters.
Follow up, Senator Stedman?
Yeah, I still need a little bit of help with it. I understand the scale or the laddered approach, and I think that's a good idea. Give me a hand on what'll be in statute, which takes more difficulty to change as time moves on, versus what you'll have, what flexibility you have in regulation.
Mr. Schmidt.
Through the chair, and again, thank you. I'm going to defer to Chief of Examinations, Tracy Reno.
Ms. Reno.
Thank you. Through the chair. On page 47 of the bill, sections 51 and 52, it addresses the fees. And basically, the department shall establish fees under this section so that the total amount of fees collected under this chapter approximately equals the department's actual total regulatory cost. So it sets the tier or the levels in statute, but then we go to regulation to get the details. So we're going to look at annual reports, how much transmission was done in the state of Alaska by each company, how many examiners are working on this section of this this industry, and then we will make sure that that fee structure covers the cost to regulate that industry. So the fiscal note that Don has will be covered by the fees paid by the companies, and it will be appropriately done in tiers so that it's a right fit for Alaskans.
Ms. Reno, the answer to the question, though, is a combination of both statutory authority as well as regulation that keeps everybody in check.
Correct.
Follows understood.
And then is this common within your department, or is there, as far as the overriding of, or the amount of control that, or the amount of specifications that are in statute versus regulations dealing with fees?
The banks and credit unions, I'm sorry, through the chair. The banks and credit unions also have an assessment. So based on how much they have, they pay a certain amount they pay biannually. But this allows, because this is such an innovative industry, everything is changing. It's, you know, it's new and all things. We want to make sure that we are able to move as appropriately as we need to if something's happening, to make sure that the coverage and the regulation is there. So we don't want to put the little guys out of business. We want to make sure that they're representative in that lower tier. And then the ones that have the higher risk and higher regulatory burden are paying the higher fee to cover that regulation that needs to be done.
Phillips, understood.
If I may, just to clarify.
Smith.
Thank you, through the chair. The banks, for example, also have a tiered structure. So it is not uncommon within our industry to have a tier that is based either on assets or volume or other things, recognizing the degree of activity within the industry.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this, as we're looking at a fee structure and more licensing structures, what's going to be the roll down cost to the user? So if you're charging fees or changing fee structures for people providing online transmissions of banking activities, is a consumer going to be paying more? And if so, what's an average increase to that consumer that would be sort of rolled down to that to end user?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator. The answer is no, it will not be, it will in no way be directly charged to the consumer. And the change to in cost to the Alaska consumer will be zero, or astonishingly approaching zero. It's the Alaska fees. For example, if you look at the fees that are paid, if we utilize the Texas fee structure, Texas has many, many, many times more people, or any of the other fee-based structures, Alaska is going to ultimately be a very vanishingly small percentage of the overall fees paid to regulators by any of these companies. So there will be no impact in the cost to Alaska consumers as a result of this.
Senator Wilson?
No, just a different question, Mr. Chair. What about entities that are currently maybe using money transactions and not using their traditional banking services for what we'll consider federally illegal services, but legal in the state of Alaska, such as marijuana transactions? How would this bill affect those type of entities?
Through the chair, and again, thank you for the question. To the extent any industry utilizes areas touched by this, the transmission of what we call fiat currency, i.e. real money, to the extent a business utilizes cryptocurrency to exchange value, to the extent that that business is legal in Alaska, they are right now immensely benefited by the existence of these services. My colleague Joan Wilson with AMCO would be in a better position to speak to this, but it's my understanding that activities that are legal under state law but illegal under federal law utilize these services routinely, and they are a lifeline for their business.
Senator Wilson?
I guess, will there be a negative impact, positive impact? I guess I'm looking for what type of impact would it have for folks under those type of licensees, for AMCO users. that use these services for payroll, for other transactions for their businesses.
Mr. Schmidt.
Through the chair, and again, thank you for the clarification. There will be a significant positive impact. You are going to be hearing today from two large industry groups that are representing, that do business with the exact businesses of which you speak. These businesses want this law to be passed in as many places as possible, and it's already been passed in 18 states. It's impending in 11 states. Payroll processors are exempt from this bill. However, if you are utilizing cryptocurrency or money transmission to pay your payroll or engage in these other activities, you will be benefited because the industry is harmonized. Alaska's laws are like other states and not unlike other states. Alaska becomes an easier place to do business rather than a more difficult place to do business. As it is right now, our existing money transmission law is sort of an oddity among the existing 50 states. And to the extent that we bring that forward and we make our law more harmonious with other states, for example, Colorado, Washington, the easier it will be for those businesses to operate here.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
I'll pass. Thank you.
One of the questions I have, Mr. Schmidt, is as you look at some of these communities, smaller communities, maybe you're not the person to go ahead and ask the question of, but in some of the small villages like I come from, where internet's connectivity is non-existent, if poor at best, how do we make sure, and cash is in short supply, how do we make sure that those people are protected from, how does this ensure that those people are protected in these small communities so that if for some reason there's identity theft or something like that, they lose a bunch of money?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the question. One of my top priorities as the Director of the Division of Banking and Securities is how can technology benefit rural Alaskans? I believe that technology has the power to greatly benefit rural Alaskans, where, you know, in years past, it was a big deal to go into a community that had a brick and mortar bank versus the ability of technology to bring those services right into your pocket. That is one of my key areas of focus. On the specifics of your question on, for example, preventing identity theft, when we perform examinations, we are making sure that these entities are following the Know Your Customer rules, that they've got appropriate information to know who it is they're dealing with, that they have policies and procedures in place to make sure that there are to prevent identity theft, to prevent the account thievery, that sort of thing. I'm going to defer to my chief of examinations to further elaborate on that answer.
Ms. Reno.
Thank you, through the chair. When we go in to do an examination, the things we're looking at, like you mentioned, was Bank Secrecy Act. So do they know who they're dealing with? Do they know where the money's going? Do they know if there's a complaint against a certain account or a certain person, they can stop that transaction, investigate it, and then make sure that that person or that account is actually who they say they are. They're not doing something suspicious, maybe taking advantage of an elder, maybe doing some kind of, there's a lot of fraud out there that we hear about every day. So when they see patterns, they have technology that can see that. They go back and look at it, investigate it, and then if there is a problem, they can file a suspicious activity report with the federal government that hands that off to law enforcement. So we make sure that those things are being in place, and they can also file a complaint with our division, and that gives us, you know, we can reach out immediately to that company. We know who to contact. We know who to talk to. They talk to us and try and help facilitate that problem and get a resolution for them.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you. What about privacy? Are we still protecting the privacy of transactions for Alaskans? Are we opening them up for more state oversight in terms of their transactions? Just wanted to throw that out there.
Mr. Schmidt.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator, for the question. Privacy is one of our top concerns. We want to do everything we can to maintain the privacy of Alaskans' information. Regarding the specifics of how we protect privacy, again, I'm going to defer to my chief of examinations.
Ms. Reno.
Thank you, through the chair. Again, when we're in examination, that's one of those things, right? Federal law, Privacy Act, GLBA, so Graham, Leach, Bliley Act, there's a lot of things they have to do, making sure that their records are secure, making sure they're not passing out personal, private, individual identification. So they have to lock down, protect those things, destroy them appropriately at appropriate times. We're looking at their technology, right? Everybody touches a computer every day. All that information is in computers. Are they updating, you know, their technology and their software? Are they destroying those records when it's appropriate? Those things are things that are looked at while we do examinations to make sure they're compliant.
And I guess my question is, are those entities giving their clientele information to the state to overview, to check, to see?
They don't hand it over to us in any reports, if that's what you're asking. I'm sorry, through the chair. They would hold that information, and we would look at it during an examination. Annual reports are just transaction number of transactions and volume and those types of things. We don't get into that granular detail of who their customer is. We would go in on an exam and ask for a sample of customer files. We would look at how they're handling those and how those transactions are being dealt with.
Thank you.
Okay. Next person that's invited to go ahead and testify is you, Mr. Reno. Do you have anything to present besides, in addition to what Mr. Schmidt talked about?
I don't have anything specific. I would just say that, you know, this is an important bill. It's not changing what we do. It's how we do it. It's bringing it along into, you know, 2024. Technology has been amazing and innovative, and we want to make sure that we're able to regulate that and understand it and have that in statute. I just have a couple of notes, and I can just make sure that I'm not missing anything. The repeal, this bill is a lot of repeal and enact because it's a model law. So industry and the regulators wrote it together. It's important. We want to be doing it the same as all the other states, so it's easier for businesses to do the work they need to do. It's the same across the country. We don't want to be that one state that's like, oh, Alaska, right? We want to make sure that we're doing it the right fit, the right feel, the right heavy, you know, the right hand. Again, the model law, we do it electronically. It lets us license these and keep them moving and keep them in business. I think that's it. I think we've answered the questions that you had for me.
So as far as Alaska goes, how do we fare in what the other states are doing? Are we behind them, ahead of them? And because of the small population and the great distances we have to travel, or that has to be covered, you know, there are advantages to being out here, and there are certainly disadvantages to being out here. Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the excellent question. I am going to share with the committee what Dean Fleer, my senior-most examiner, he works for Ms. Reno. Alaska lacks the tools. Alaska lacks the tools. Mr. Fleer was recently a lead examiner on the examination of American Express Travel Services. That is to say, he was chosen to lead an examination that was conducted in coordination with many financial heavyweights, California and New York among them. Mr. Fleer is an exceptionally well-qualified financial examiner, and we are fortunate, and all Alaskans are fortunate, to have him working to ensure the safety and soundness of our financial systems. But he goes into these examinations, and he's looking at the books and records and the operations of these businesses, and he says, I don't have the tools.
So Mr. Schmidt, when you don't have the tools, are you talking about the regulatory and statutory tools that are necessary for them to carry out the transaction, the money transactions that are out there, or the internet connection and all those other ancillary parts that are there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the clarification. He lacks the statutory tools, the basis in the statute to ensure the safety and soundness of the operations of these businesses. He goes on an examination, and the other states that he's performing the examination with, they have the statutory tools available to them to ensure the safety and soundness of the operation, whereas Mr. Fleer reports to me that under the existing statute, he lacks the tools to do the things that are necessary to help protect Alaskans.
And this bill, SB 84, will go ahead and get us equal to the rest of this?
Yes, Mr.
Chair. Give him what he needs, I guess is what it is.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. So since we're having this conversation, I think somebody's going to probably cover the fiscal note, but I'm looking at the five employees. I don't see any forensic examiner in here. You probably got them in your department.
Through the chair, and thank you for the excellent question. Actually, information technology-based or forensics examinations has been a longstanding topic of conversation between Ms. Reno and I, and I hope to have a financial examiner on an information technology-centric financial examiner on our team eventually. To speak to what those exact positions are going to be at, I'm going to defer to my operations manager, Ms. Dawn Hanisch.
Yeah, we can wait, Mr. Chairman, when that's part of your schedule. I'm fine that you answered my question.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Ms. Hanisch was the next one that was going to be up for.
Thank you.
Ms. Hanisch, please identify yourself for the record. And go ahead with your presentation, and if you could answer Senator Bishop's question.
Of course, thank you. I'm Dawn Hanisch, Division Operations Manager for the Division of Banking and Securities. And through the chair, Senator Bishop, thank you for your question. We look at these five positions as the tools that we need to be able to meet the demand of this industry. These positions that we have range from a licensing examiner who processes the actual license application and also processes renewals, all the way up to a new chief so that we can have enough of our financial examiner force, who are absolute subject matter experts, be leading teams most efficiently. So we have also are adding a program coordinator one for our licensing team. Currently, they do not have a supervisor for that team. And then we're also asking for two more financial examiners, which would be on Ms. Reno's team, doing those deep dives into basically auditing financial institutions. And with the amount of increase we've seen in this industry, these five positions are going to have their hands full when they get started.
Follow-up question, Senator Bishop?
Do you have access to a third-party forensics examiner if you need one, if you suspect something?
Through the chair, and thank you for the question. Most states have an information technology or a forensic style examiner. These examinations are conducted on a multi-state basis. So, for example, the American Express one, I think there was maybe 8 or 10 different states involved, including some of the really, really big ones. It is important that we be able to collaborate with other states. But yes, if we were to suspect fraud, if we were to believe that there was something criminal potentially happening, we would be able to access experts should we so need.
Thank you, sir.
Ms. Hanisch, do we have anything more to present in addition to what's already been presented?
Not at this time, unless there's any questions regarding the fiscal note.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a follow-up question for Senator Bishop. You know, you talked about the three positions initially and then going up to five positions. So my understanding is this is going to be revenue neutral to the state. You're going to have a fee structure that will cover these new employees, which is important as our budgets get tighter and tighter. And then if you can talk a little bit about how easy or difficult you think it's going to be to find these five people. We seem to have more vacancies in our agencies than we'd like. So if you can help us with that.
Mr. Schmidt.
Through the chair, thank you for the excellent question that I am particularly proud to answer. The division, as of recently, added a 27th PCN. Until a couple of months ago, we had 26 PCNs. In December of 2021, when I took this position, we had a 30% vacancy rate. We were fully staffed. We had zero vacancies as of fall of 2022. As of now, we have two vacancies in the original 26. Much of that has resulted from a more senior person leaving state service and people advancing up so that the vacancy just sort of moves down the organization chart. I am quite confident that we will be able to fill these vacancies.
All up, Senator Stedman. Okay. Any further questions by members of the committee for Mr. Schmidt and his staff? If not, we'll go on to invited testimony. Mr. Laka Peacock with the Alaska Prepaid Credit Card LLC from Nome. Are you on, sir?
Yes. Good morning.
Please identify yourself for the record and go through the presentation.
Hi, good morning. My name is Laka Peacock. Little background, I was born in Costa View, currently reside in Nome, and I run a business, my wife and I, called Kuyana Card, and it's basically banking services for rural Alaska, primarily in the smaller villages, not the hubs like, you know, Nome, Dillingham, Kotze, but all the surrounding communities for people that don't have access to traditional banking services. Started it back in 2014. If I would have known the difficulties associated with it, may not have gotten into it. However, with that said, our cardholders in these small villages, ranging all the way from, you know, Nastuyahuk, all the way up to, you know, Wainwright. We've got cardholders, you know, all over the state, and we've kind of, they've come to rely on our services, our banking services. No other options in many cases in these small villages. So at this point, we're kind of providing a service that I don't see any way of getting out of, which relates to this bill and hopefully making it easier on really, really small places like ours, who are treated exactly the same way as mentioned earlier, Google Pay. And I think I can illustrate that with a short story. You guys were talking about audits earlier. We are audited just like all the other big places. And on our first audit, you know, we had someone from the Division of Banking fly all the way to Nome. We paid for all that. We paid for their airfare. I paid for their lodging, which in Nome, if anyone's from rural Alaska, is not cheap, et cetera, et cetera. Their entire time by the hour, the meals, everything. And when she arrived, she was tired, she said, and she had just returned from auditing Google Pay. And I was shocked. I didn't realize this. I didn't realize we were on the same playing field as Google Pay. She said, your audit is nothing different than theirs. You will pay the same. All the documents required, everything is the same. And from that point on, it's, you know, continued to be a struggle that we're on that same playing field. Not only for the cost, we pay the same bond as them, nothing different. You know, we pay the same fees. We have the exact same audits, the same paperwork required. Which for a small business like mine with just, you know, one single employee staying on top of the regulatory stuff, it's next to impossible, as probably some of the Division of Banking people could testify to. I am, you know, always struggling to stay on top of it. With that said, very briefly, so we're looking, you know, for some sort of where we could be, you know, like I said earlier, you know, volumes, you know, we're, you know, much smaller than these places. And so if there was, you know, some sort of levels with the requirements and the fees and things like that. We are providing basically the ability, and I think a quick one more last story on this, the service that we're providing in these villages. We are allowing cardholders to actually make deposits by walking into their local store, taking a check or money order, giving it to the store employee, and we're putting that money on their card. So they are immediately able to spend it there in the village. They do not have to mail their check to a bank in Anchorage. And in addition, they can also pick up a card right in the village. They don't need to wait for it in the mail. And so one quick story, we had a cardholder, January 30 below in one of the small villages, ran out of stove oil, right? And they were simply able to, rather than having, they had had previously a direct express card for the Social Security benefit, and they were waiting 3 weeks, you know, for their card to come in the mail with literally their $1,000 sitting on it in the mail somewhere and not able to buy the stove oil with their Guana card. They walked into the store, immediately got a new card and paid for the stove oil. So, you know, we're providing the service out there. We're hoping to continue to provide it, but it's gotten to the point where it's just become almost impossible for a small, you know, business like ours to provide this kind of service that is needed and wanted. And I'm just hoping that some regulation can be reduced to keep us in business. And that's all I have for today. Appreciate the time.
Do you have any questions for Mr. Peacock by members of the committee? So, Mr. Peacock, you're talking about you were looking for some type of regulation to make it so that life out there in rural Alaska is a little bit easier. What specifically were you talking about?
Yeah, so on the side of the Division of Banking Services, you know, and what we have to do for required paperwork for them, like I said, it's on the same as Google Pay, the same fees we're paying. So financially, we just, you know, can barely afford to do it. Time-wise, we can barely afford to stay on top of it. We want to continue to provide, you know, the service because I think it's important that, as mentioned earlier, with the technology coming around, we're able to provide this kind of a service out there. We want to continue doing it. Our cardholders are asking us to continue providing it, but we're basically being kind of pushed out by the regulation and the fees, where none of the larger places are going to go in and do what we're doing, right? I mean, even Alaska Commercial Company at one point, you know, it was a large store in rural Alaska, was trying to provide this sort of prepaid banking services. And these, by the way, primarily for cardholders that have had, of course, they can get a bank account from other places and do these transactions remotely. But many of them have been shut down because of overdraft, things like that, reported to check systems. So they can no longer get bank accounts with, you know, the global credit unions of the world and the Wells Fargo's and Northman's and all these places. They just can't anymore. And so their only options are things like these prepaid cards, right? And so that's the service we're providing. So we're bringing it directly to the village. We're bringing banking right there, you know, to the village. We think it's important, as some of the stories I relayed to you. But we can't continue to compete, and provide a service if we're going to be treated the same as a billions and billion dollar company. You know, I used to work in the banking industry, and when I worked for National Bank of Alaska, they weren't treated the same as the small credit union, right? There were these levels. The credit union was not required to have as much money on hold. They didn't have all the same regulations, right? It was just lesser things for them because they were, you know, a $20 million credit union versus a billion-dollar bank. So that's kind of what we're looking for.
Any other questions for Mr. Peacock, my members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming out this morning, and thank you for the service you have for the people in the district that I represent.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Schmidt, do you want to comment on his possible amendment that could be put together for this? Is it practical, impractical for this legislation, or should it be dealt with at a future time?
Mr. Chair, thank you. This bill would provide a rapid... Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill would provide a rapid and significant benefit to Mr. Peacock's business by altering the fee structure so that he is not set on the same field as the Google Pays, Apple Pays, Cash Apps, etc. Of the world. And I would say that we as a division, it is our mission to try to bring companies into compliance through collaboration. And we do feel that we collaborate with Mr. Peacock and other smaller Alaska businesses on a regular basis in ways that is appropriate for their business models.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Passing this bill, would a small business like the one we just heard from, would there be any new compliance requirements, new reports, new documents they have to provide to the division, or would it be the same? You know, would Mr. Peacock have the same reports or compliance reports or more?
Schmidt.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. No, no new documents, no new reports, no new requirements.
So follow-up, Senator Keel.
Yeah, another follow-up. We talked about the fee structure. The other change, I think, in the bill that differentiates the little guys from the big guys is the minimum net worth. Am I reading the bill correctly that a small operator like this would no longer have the same minimum net worth requirements as the Google Pays, the Apple Pays?
Mr. Schmidt.
Through the chair, and again, thank you for the question. As mentioned before, this is a model law, and looking at the model law, the minimum net worth requirement we thought was not the right fit for Alaska, was not the right fit for smaller businesses, it was not the right fit for a more sparsely populated state, so we significantly reduced the net worth requirements from the model law to the Alaska version of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. If there's no further questions, so we'll go ahead and go on to our next invited testimony. That's Mr. Adam Fleischer, the Money Services Roundtable. Mr. Fleischer, are you on, sir?
Yes, hello. This is Adam Fleischer from the Money Services Roundtable.
Go ahead with the presentation. Identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Adam Fleischer. I represent the Money Services Roundtable, as well as many other companies that engage in money transmission and other activities that would be covered by this new model law and that are generally covered by the current Alaska money transmission law. I'd like to give brief testimony that largely reaffirms the discussions that have taken place so far and the emphasis placed by Director Schmidt on the, frankly, what we see as an industry, the kind of the holy grail that is offered by the model law, provided that it is uniformly adopted on a national basis in the United States, including in Alaska. And this is the ability to reduce regulatory burden while at the same time enhancing customer protection and the health and safety and soundness of the industry as a whole. And the legislation does this, in my view, in two ways. First, it modernizes various elements of the regulation of money transmitters to reflect the diversity of the nature of money transmission services today. Electronic payment services, your more traditional walk-up agent location money transmission services, and, you know, in light of the emphasis on technology-neutral activities or technology-neutral approach to regulation, the provision of money transmission and related payment services through new or different technologies, including virtual currencies. The first is that, the legislation brings up to, into kind of more aligned with modern and current ways of engaging in provision of financial services by non-bank money transmitters. And the second, and this is of particular significance for the Money Services Roundtable, whose members, which include Ria Financial Services, American Express, Western Union, and MoneyGram, all operate on a national basis. Harmonization of money transmission law between and among states is a significant regulatory burden relief for industry without any compromise, safety and soundness, and customer protection. And this is just, frankly, to some degree, an administrative issue. Licensed money transmitters today must comply with money transmission law on a state-by-state basis. Well, from the perspective of any particular state, its law can exist in the vacuum of that state. You know, in other words, what that law is what the licensee has to comply with. When a licensee is faced with 50, 52, 53, if you include territories, 52, 53 different laws, if each law has two, three, four different elements of it, you know, elements that are distinct as between that law and laws in other states, a nationally licensed money transmitter has to keep track, in addition to its core requirements for safety and soundness compliance, has to keep track of an additional 200 unique requirements, just an illustration, right? You know, three, four deviations per state, a 50 or so jurisdiction. So the value in harmonization from industry perspective is primarily the ability to have a lesser regulatory burden by virtue of having one standard to adhere to. And it also provides benefit, as discussed by Director Schmidt and others, in the course of examination and oversight of regulated financial institutions of these licensed money transmitters. And that is because they are able to be examined on a consistent standard. They are able to communicate with their regulators based on a consistent, uniform standard. Another feature of the model law that I feel it is important to note is that the intention of this law to achieve those two goals, right, of modernization and improved harmonization, did not require drastic changes over existing regulation of money transmitters. Rather, it simply required updating, and it's something that both industry and regulators could support and be comfortable with that would enable adoption on a widespread basis. So the model law is built on top of, to some degree, the existing Uniform Money Services Act. That formed the basis of this legislation when the drafting and the creation of it by CSBS began. By starting with the Uniform Money Services Act, we were able to take all of the insights and learnings that have happened before in this industry and use that as a starting point and build on top of it, as opposed to working out a completely whole cloth. And you see that illustrated in SB 84, because Alaska is one of the states that has an existing money transmission law largely based on that Uniform Act from about 20 years ago. And therefore, these changes and these updates and the new law, while likely to have very significant benefits for industry and, as you heard, for the regulation of industry, actually does not create significant change or disruption to either, I think, industry or the regulators, to the extent that we have to learn an entirely new way of being regulated or rebuild existing systems or anything like that. It's an incremental change, and the value of an incremental change is really where it focuses on modernization, things like fees, things like reporting and record keeping, along with the ability to have a similar monetary emission law in Alaska and in, you know, many, many other states that have adopted or are planning to adopt the new money transmission legislation based on the model law. One final point I would like to make is continuing on this theme. There is one element of the legislation that does give industry pause, and this is on page 5, section 6, AS 0655-1091. This is a requirement relating to the provision of fingerprinting for control persons of licensed money transmitters, the officers and directors of the licensee, is generally who that refers to. Historically, when I started working in this space about 12 years ago, licensed money transmitters and their officers and directors were required to go through federal background checks using fingerprints for purposes of confirming that they were appropriate and fit to be controlling individuals of a regulated financial institution. At the time, it was a significantly burdensome process because you had to go get paper fingerprint cards with different requirements for each of the different states and submit those fingerprint cards directly to various different state and federal locations where they could be processed. This burden of having to do separate and distinct fingerprinting for each of these individuals has largely been relieved to the adoption and the use of the NMLS system, which is operated by CSDS, and enables fingerprinting to be done once and submitted through a centralized processing solution. And that information regarding the fingerprint results is then provided to all participating states. The model law legislation, or the draft legislation prepared by CSDS with industry and regulator support, is consistent with this current practice of fingerprint background checks being conducted through the NMLS system. However, the provision in SB 84 that I just referred to, 0655-1091, would require the fingerprints to be submitted directly to the department, and so therefore would require a separate and unique fingerprinting process specific to Alaska for licensed money transmission control persons, officers, and directors. This, unfortunately, in its current form, actually would be an increase in regulatory burden and operational burden for licensees and others that operate in Alaska, because they would have to add an additional fingerprinting process on top of the standardized NMLS process. So, in one sense, this is an exception that proves the rule of this legislation, which would otherwise really go very far toward achieving and facilitating harmonization of money transmission law in Alaska and other states that have adopted the model law or that have legislation currently that aligns with the model law. And so that's just the one thing that I would note as a caveat to the general support for the Money Services Roundtable for SB 84. I'm happy to take any questions that there may be, and thank you very much for your time.
Do you have any questions for Mr. Fleischer by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming out, Mr. Fleischer.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt, do you want to comment on the additional fingerprint requirements that he just alluded to as to why they should be or why they shouldn't be put in place?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the excellent question, and I very much want to comment upon them. As presented in the bill originally, we had the NMLS-based centralized uniform fingerprint and background check. At some point, this bill was amended. It was amended when it came out of the Judiciary Committee. We don't know why. We didn't ask for it. We don't know where this came from, but it was changed to fingerprint cards sent to the division and processed by the Department of Public Safety. We would very much prefer to participate in the nationwide, streamlined, unified system that Mr. Fleischer described.
Any comments or concerns by members of the committee by the comments that were just made by Mr. Schmidt or Mr. Fleischer? Senator Bishop.
Yes, to the director. So these fingerprints currently, are they warehoused like in the FBI, or who holds the MasterCard of these fingerprints?
Mr. Schmidt.
They are provided to the Nationwide Multi-State Licensing Service, which is run by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. How they handle them, whether they destroy them after a period of time, I do not know. But what I would say is there would be less privacy, more regulatory burden, more delay, less business-friendly climate, significant increases in the time it takes to process these applications. If we have to receive paper fingerprint cards, send them off to the Department of Public Safety and have them processed in that way. It would be one more step where if you're a up and coming, you're the next PayPal. Oh my gosh, if we're going to do business in Alaska, we have to stand on our heads and send them we're going to have to do a whole other set of fingerprint cards, send it to Alaska. And it's going to be one more reason for the next innovative dynamic financial services company to not do business here.
Follow-up, Senator Click.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little, you operate in this world every day. I don't. So
lucky you.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're there. Because you know your onions. But is the Treasury Department the ultimate, because it's a banking industry. So I just want to know who and you can get back with this, and I'm sorry to belabor this point, but I just want to know who is the repository. And you answered me, but is this group under the Treasury Department?
Mr. Schmidt.
I'm about to defer to Ms. Reno, my Chief of Examinations, but the Conference of State Bank Supervisors is a consortium of state regulators, and they're the ones that run this nationwide multi-state licensing service. The background check itself is performed by the FBI. So
Ms. Reno.
With that, to defer to Ms. Reno.
Thank you, through the chair, Tracy Reno. The fingerprints are done electronically. They go to a vendor where they're ever in their city, they have one. They go do their electronic fingerprints. It's sent directly to the NMLS, which is a nationwide licensing system. They hold them for 3 years and then they expire. So onboarding every control person that makes those decisions in those companies, the board of directors, there's a certain list of people. They have to go get fingerprints done. The way the bill is currently written, that's a problem because we would have to somebody have to ask us, I want to do fingerprints. Okay, here's your cards, mail them to them. They get their fingerprints, mail them back. Then we mail them to the troopers and they process them for a month or two. Then they send it back. It would significantly slow down the process for licensing. And we would like to amend that part of the bill so that it goes back to the original language and it would allow the electronic fingerprints to be run through the NMLS, through the FBI. And the requirement is that language has to be in the statute approved by the legislature to allow us to do that.
Follow up?
Officer Bridger.
So if I heard you correctly, my words, this is duplicative and not needed.
It's through the chair, it is burdensome on industry and the division to have paper fingerprints process. We would prefer and really need, and businesses need it, to have electronic fingerprints run through the NMLS, through the FBI.
Thank you. FBI, good word.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so for my clarity, it looks like this may have been put in to conform to how we do other fingerprints, which are based on Alaska's Department of Public Safety's access to the FBI database. Am I understanding correctly that the NMLS has independent access to those FBI records and that you don't need DPS, Alaska's Department of Public Safety, access?
Ms. Reno.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Any further question by members of the committee for? One of the questions I have is, since Mr. Peacock is a member of my district, would he be happier with, is this an added burden with him having this amendment put onto it, or does he care? On his level, is it a concern?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. Mr. Peacock is going to have to give one set of one person's fingerprints because he potentially his wife, but he's going to have to give a set of fingerprints. To the extent that he can do it, that he's in a community where he can do electronic fingerprints, does Noam have access to electronic? We don't know whether or not Noam has access to electronic fingerprints. For him, it won't really necessarily make a difference. For the other money transmitters, it's a very significant difference having to mail physical cards back and forth, wait for DPS, et cetera, as opposed to doing it all electronically.
Okay. Thank you very much. If there's no further question by members of the committee, we'll go ahead to our next invited testimony. That's Mr. Adam Atlas with the Money Services Business Association. Are you on, sir?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I am here, Adam Atlas.
Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, sir. My name is Adam Atlas, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Money Services Business Association. I'm an advisor to the association, and I'm standing in for our executive director, Kathy Tomasovsky. The MSBA, the association I'm speaking on behalf of, is one of the nation's largest trade associations focused on the non-bank money services industry. Its membership includes licensed money transmitters and their agents and authorized delegates, payment card issuers, distributors, payment processors, international remittance companies, bill payments companies, and other similar businesses, as well as virtual currency exchanges, administrators, and e-wallet providers. The MSBA has worked along with other industry representatives and state regulators to give input to the Uniform Money Transmission Modernization Act, which was the basis of the act which is before you right now, the bill that is before you right now. SB 84 is key to implementing the model law. As we've heard from other witnesses today, it will clarify the rules around licensing and regulation for money transmitters, which include companies that handle several trillions of dollars annually, and it will offer offer essential financial services to Alaskans. Specifically, SB 84 provisions create a national standard for consumer protections, clarify and standardize definitions of regulated activity, and streamline the state's ability to license and examine money transmitters through the nationwide multi-state licensing system. That's the system we were hearing about a few minutes ago that handles the fingerprints. Ensuring that customers are protected and payments companies are regulated in the same manner across all jurisdictions. It is our view that our membership, that is to say money transmitters that are licensed in the state of Alaska and often elsewhere, will benefit from the bill that you are considering right now because it will put in a consistent framework of robust protections as opposed to the earlier patchwork of state laws that were substantively different from one state to another. In addition, perhaps more importantly for your consideration, our view is that customers in the state of Alaska of these money services businesses will also benefit because the money transmitters and money services businesses being regulated will be regulated to a uniform standard across multiple states. We also believe that, as a final note, that adopting this bill will allow Alaskan entrepreneurs to access markets outside of Alaska by having become licensed, first of all, under the model law or the law that is similar to the model law in Alaska, and it'll make it that much easier for them to expand their businesses into other states. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for giving us time to be here, and I'm pleased to answer any questions.
Do we have any questions from members of the committee for Mr. Atlas? We don't have any further questions for you, Mr. Atlas. Thank you very much for coming out this morning.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt, do you want to comment on his testimony? Does it indeed give a more robust protection for the Alaskan financial consumer?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. It absolutely does. I concur in Mr. Atlas's testimony. This bill is necessary to ensure harmony, to keep Alaska open for business, for it to be attractive to do business in Alaska, because we have the same rules of the road, that we are not some unique one-off. Everybody else has got a round peg, but we're the square peg, that sort of situation. Okay. Also, to briefly comment on a comment by Senator Bishop, we, the Division of Banking and Securities, myself as director, Tracy Reno as my chief of examinations, Don Hanisch, my operations manager, and my chief of securities, Ann Svilich, we take our job exceedingly seriously. This, the industries we regulate touch Alaska to the tunes of many, many billions of dollars. And I want to assure all members of the committee that we are engaged regularly with making sure that we are doing everything we can to make sure Alaskans are protected to the greatest extent possible, and that all of our financial services industries are operated in a safe and sound manner.
Okay, thank you very much for presenting the bill this morning and what's in it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll set this bill aside, and our next bill up is Senate Bill 206, Workers' Compensation Stay-at-Work Program by Senator Alvy Gray Jackson. This is the first hearing for this bill. I'd like to invite Senator Gray Jackson up to the table and go ahead and present the bill. She has her trusty staffer with her. So identify yourself for the record, Senator, and go ahead with your presentation.
Senator Alvy Gray Jackson, District G in Anchorage. I'd like to thank Mr. Chairman and the committee for hearing this very important bill that I believe is going to help with our workforce shortage. In June of 2023, Senator Borkman and I attended a forum that was sponsored by the Council of State Governments and the U.S. Department of Labor's State Exchange on Employment and Disabilities, which addressed stay-at-work, return-to-work programs throughout the country. We joined attendees from Kansas, Kentucky, Massachusetts, and Minnesota, in addition to staff from the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Also in attendance was the Deputy Assistant Secretary Jennifer Sheehy from the United States Department of Labor, Office of Disability Employment Policy, among other prominent speakers. SEED and its partners assist states and localities interested in developing and implementing inclusive workforce development policies. We learned about the benefits of stay-at-work, return-to-work policies and programs, which included interacting with subject matter experts to learn strategies for better designing, implementing, and evaluating stay-at-work, return-to-work policies and programs. We heard from state policymakers regarding successes and challenges around stay-at-work, return-to-work, including the retaining employment and talent after injury illness network initiative. We heard from people who have participated in and benefited from the State Work Return to Work initiatives, which provided an understanding of their challenges and experiences. We connected and worked with other members of our state team to strengthen relationships and identify opportunities for future collaboration. And we also developed an action plan for improving State Work Return to Work policies and programs in our state. And so, Mr. Chairman, at the end of the forum, our task was to draft a bill which included a return-to-work coordinated plan to assist employers and employees to return to the workforce, thus Senate Bill 206. Each year, countless workers face the challenges of injuries, illnesses, or changes in their disability status after leading to significant time away from work. This not only affects their livelihoods, but also impacts the workforce and economy at large. Senate Bill 206, which would establish the Stay at Work and Return to Work program, seeks to restore Alaska's once strong and healthy workforce. Through the creation of this program, an injured worker may elect assistance to return to work with their employer at the time of injury. The program is optional and can be declined by a worker or an employer. These programs focus on strategies that retain or re-engage workers experiencing such challenges, aiming to swiftly integrate them into the workforce. By providing necessary support and resources, stay-at-work, return-to-work programs ensure that workers can continue their careers despite new health challenges, thereby maintaining a robust and resilient workforce. The goal of a program is to return a worker to the same position with the same employer or to a modified position with the same employer after an injury or occupational disease occurs. Furthermore, services provided as part of the assistance program are provided in lieu of reemployment services. Changes under this bill would be optimized by the ability of the insurer, rehabilitation specialist, and the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to provide one another necessary information. For example, the Department of Labor shall advise the insurer and employer of the request for assistance, and the services offered as part of the program are available as a service apart from a determination regarding indemnity benefits. So across the United States, like Oregon and Montana, they have made significant strides in implementing the State Work Return to Work initiatives. These programs have demonstrated success in reducing the time employees spend away from work due to disabilities or injuries, offering financial incentives, and facilitating necessary workplace adjustments. The adoption of similar legislation in Alaska promises substantial benefits. It can enhance our state's workforce stability, reduce the economic impact of prolonged employee absence, and promote a more inclusive and supportive work environment. By passing this legislation, Alaska can join other states in leading the way towards a more adaptable and supportive workforce, ultimately benefiting both our economy and the well-being of Alaska workers. Mr. Chairman, if the committee would like, my staff, Luma Diaz, can go over the section analysis.
Actually, Ms. Senator Gray-Jackson, I'd like to have the invited testimony done first, and then we'll go over the sectional analysis. That's okay with you?
Of course. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Diaz, you're welcome to stay at the table. Our invited testimony this morning is Charles Collins, the Director of Division of Workers' Compensation, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Mr. Collins, please come out and give us a detailed description of how this program would work. And if we have time, could you touch on the fiscal note as well?
Thank you and good morning. Charles Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation, State of Alaska, Department of Labor. As Senator Gray-Jackson so eloquently put it, upon following other states' leads and knowing the challenges that the state of Alaska has had with some of our workforce, receiving injury, and due to the nature of the work in Alaska, quite often some of those injuries can be catastrophic. We felt that a better service might be on how to work our injured workers back into work. So the facts of the matter are that in Alaska, if a worker misses 7 days, so if I take away all the injuries that resolve within 7 days. So if they're off more than 7 days, our average time off of work after that is 14 weeks. Statistics show that 13 weeks away from the job, you're a 50-50 chance of ever getting a job again. Not just the same job, but any job. And what we see is people that have been injured or disabled to the point where they're off for, 3 or 4 months, they go through their workers' compensation benefits. They might have some unemployment insurance benefits. Then it's off to Social Security, and they're no longer a productive portion of the workforce. In the governor's move to improve the workforce in Alaska and recent events that have caused us to carefully look at the workforce across the nation, but especially in Alaska, our own reports from research and analysis at the Department of Labor show a 63.5% participation rate, a very low participation rate. And so workers' compensation, we looked at what our little part of that could be done. Currently in Alaska, we have a reemployment law, 2330.041 outlines reemployment law. It needs some adjusting, but it's what we have right now. That reemployment law allows people to be retrained if they are not able to go back to the original job they have. So there's some benefits there. Unfortunately, we have about 500 people a year, give or take, apply to that. And about 6 people will finish the plan. So a very steep fall off. The problem there is engagement. We most of us realize that, believe it or not, our workplace becomes the place where we get to know people, friends. They get to be that inner core. There's a connection for most of us between who we work with, where we work at, and who we are. And this bill allows an avenue for employers and employees to work together to continue that connection. So what we're looking for is a nexus between the injured worker and their employer. And we believe the department can do this simply with the stay-at-work program. The biggest problem right now is actually the communication factor. So as a longtime employer in the state of Alaska, let me explain how sometimes that works for you. You know, one of my employees gets hurt the first week, I'm checking on them every day, you know, make sure they're doing okay. You know, the second week, I'm starting to get busy, but I still check in a couple of times that week to see how they are. The third week, I'm running payroll and I'm noticing production is down. So I'm thinking, well, if I can't get this person back, I may need to look at getting a temp or somebody else. The fourth week, I forgot their name because now I have somebody working because my business has to survive and I have other families to take care of. And the fifth week just gets worse and worse and worse. What we are looking to do is to strengthen that communication by having a position at the workers' compensation that would be that nexus between the employee, the employer, the medical community, the adjuster. And so what we came up with is this plan that is covered under SB 206, where when an employee is going to be out for a long time, we jump on this quickly. Currently, right now, it can be as many as over 200 days before the communication between our reemployment division and the employee happens. It quite often isn't that long, but it could be 206 days before anything happens. We've figured this out. We want to cut that down, and by changing the statutes, we think we can cut it down to 49 days so that much quicker we have communication between people and we're talking to the employer and the employee and saying, okay, what can they do? What are they able to do? What will the doctor allow them to do? Can we change the job? And then this position would be able to talk to the employer and say, okay, you need some assistance, maybe some technology, maybe some ergonomics or something to allow this employee to participate. And maybe the employee can only participate part-time, but we become that communication nexus and we bring that employee back in there. And what we heard over and over again when we were in Minneapolis is work is recovery. When you come back to work, instead of sitting around, at home or whatever and being, working your injury, you're going back to work, you're having that connection, you're exercising, your mind, body, and spirit, and you're coming back to work. And so this is what we are looking for to do. As for the fiscal note, you'll notice that we are adding one position here, a program coordinator position, that would be that person, that nexus. That position would work right in the reemployment and rehabilitation division we have now. An answer to my RBA, the Reemployment Benefits Administrator, that would answer to that person and that would give us the bandwidth to follow up with these employees that are out of work. We're going to try to contact them as quick as within 14 days of this position. Right now, we don't have the ability to do that. And at any given time right now, we have 200 to 300 plan evaluations going on. And we'll have 50 to 60 plans that are being monitored. We just don't have the bandwidth to get much more communication done with that. So this program coordinator position needs to be somebody that's special. So that's why we wanted to get with a program coordinator. They need to have the expertise to talk to the medical community. They need to be able to talk to employers. They need to be able to talk to employees. They need to be able to put all of that together into a package. And with Senator Gray Jackson's help, we feel like we have the beginnings of a good bill here to make that work.
OK.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Mr. Collins? Senator Merrick? Nobody has any questions. Thank you very much for coming up this morning.
Thank you.
So we'll go ahead next with your permission, Senator Jackson, Gray Jackson. We'll have the sectional analysis done by your staffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your sectional analysis.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Luma Diaz, staff to Senator Gray Jackson, and I'm going to read the sectional analysis of Senate Bill 206. Section 1 amends AS 23.30.005H by adding a reference to new stay-at-work program under AS 23.30.043. Section 2 amends existing statute AS 23.30.041B by moving the annual reporting of employment benefits from May until October to match the other annual reports due, includes each specific reporting criteria. Section 3 makes changes to AS 23.30.041C, adding 30 days to the time of required employment evaluations to allow for the medical stability of claimants. The amendment requires the Workers' Compensation Division to notify injured employees of rights under this section within 25 days of inability to return to the employee's employment at the time of injury, including the option of participation in the stay-at-work program. Section 4 amends AS 23.30.041F by adding that an employee is not eligible for employment benefits if his selection under AS 23.30.041C is not made, or if an employee has completed a stay-at-work program previously or has been found non-corporative in the stay-at-work process under AS 23.30.043L. Section 5, a new section, Section 23.30.043, it's added to establish a stay-at-work benefit program. A new position is added as a subject matter expert to oversee the program. A rehabilitation specialist is assigned to develop a stay-at-work program plan requiring participation and approval for the employee, employer, and attending physician, and a timeline for submission of plan. Costs are the responsibility of the employer and shall not exceed $3,000. The maximum time frame is 2 years. Non-corporation is defined. Participation is voluntary. The employee may pursue reemployment benefits under AS 23.30.041 as an alternative if the employer chooses not to participate. An appeal process is outlined. Section 6 amends existing statute AS 23.30.100A by adjusting the time frame by 15 days for notification of a work-related injury or death. Section 7 amends AS 23.30.105A by adding a reference to a new stay-at-work program established under AS 23.30.043. Section 8 sets an effective date.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Ms. Diaz on the sectional analysis? One question I do have under section, I'm sorry, Senator Wilson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on the participation is voluntary. Is it voluntary for the participant or the employer or both?
I believe it's for both.
Okay. I hear, see the nod. Yes. Thank you.
Any further questions by members of the committee for either the bill sponsor or staffer? The question I have under Section 5, you talk about a rehabilitation specialist. Are these people licensed, and are they, what's their availability? Are they hard to find for the person that gets hurt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll have to refer that question to Mr. Collins if I can.
Collins, please come on up and answer the question if you can, which is dealing with rehabilitation specialists.
Through the chair, currently we already engage with these rehabilitation specialists. They are private. It's a private industry in the state. Currently, I believe we have 16, it might be 17, that are active in the state right now. The credentials for becoming a rehabilitation specialist are quite high, a very specialized thing. As a matter of note, our RBA that runs the that portion of the division is qualified, and then DVR has several in their division, and great people, good industry.
Okay. Any further questions by members of the committee for the bill sponsor or the Mr. Collins? If not, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside. That concludes our agenda for this morning. The next hearing will be tomorrow at 9 a.m. We have one bill on the agenda, that's Senate Bill 151, Murdered and Missing Indigenous Persons. We may also bring up other bills that have been previously heard, which will be announced shortly. With that, if there's no other business before the coming, before the business to become before the committee, we are adjourned at 11 or at 10:45 p.m. a.m.